The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
a weapon or a drug. You can be the outcast or be the backlash of somebody's lack of love.
Lack of love.
Or you can start speaking up.
Nothing's gonna hurt you the way the words do when they settle me.
Welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. My name is Ann Rostosky. I'm the president of the board and today's worship leader. So today you're in for a real treat. We're going to celebrate Unitarian Universalist women in history. And I have to tell you, I've been a Unitarian for a very long time, probably 40 years, and I've never heard of some of these women. So it's kind of cool that we have some that are well known that you'll recognize their names, but we also have a few others that you probably hadn't heard of before. And maybe you have, but I hadn't. So I'd like to say, if this is your first time here and you're not familiar with Unitarian Universalism, there is a literature rack in the lobby. So feel free to take a brochure. We encourage you to visit more than once because today is a lay-led service, but we also have a minister and he will be leading our service next Sunday, Reverend Andrew Weber. So thank you for being here. If you're here in person or on Zoom, we welcome everyone. And whoever you love, wherever you are in your spiritual journey, whatever you believe, we welcome you here today. And now I will turn the podium over to Elise Fisher, and she will be doing the chalice lighting.
Thanks, Anne. Good morning, I'm Elise Fisher. This morning we'll light the chalice by words of Sophia Leone's Fass. First, I'd like to tell you a little bit about her. She was 102 years old when she passed. She was a progressive religious educator who believed deeply in engaging children where they lived, in the world of their daily lives, in the process of equipping them to deal with everyday problems. She also sought to stimulate their sense of wonder and curiosity about life. Her approach to religious education, as described in her book, Today's Children's and Yesterday's Heritage, made a radical departure from traditional content and methods. Instead of telling children what they ought to believe, she encouraged them to ponder themselves, the mysteries of the universe and human destiny. One's faith, she wrote, is the philosophy of life that gathers up into one emotional whole, all the specific beliefs one holds about many kinds of things in many areas of life. Fass pioneered in exposing children to their stories, myths, and legends of other cultures, and to the discoveries of science. In place of rigid lesson plans and structured learning, she introduced painting, role-playing, and creative self-expression. In place of beliefs that are divisive, discriminatory, and damaging, she promoted beliefs that are expansive, inclusive, and gateways to wider understanding. She insisted that there is no special religious knowledge. Almost single-handedly, she shifted religious education from Bible-centered to experience-centered learning, and from adult-driven to children-driven pedagogy. She was on the leading edge of developments in the field of religious education and practice. As the first female faculty member at the Union Theological Seminary, she developed ideas in the context of the experimental Sunday school at Columbia University's Teachers College, the Union School of Religion, and the Riverside Church School, each of them laboratories of religious education theory and methods. No doubt, were she writing and teaching today, she would look for many new ways of implementing her philosophy to creative religious development. And now we'll light the chalice to words of Sophia Leone's Fass. Many of the past generation and many of today. Many of the past generation and many of today have found the abiding values in prayer, the quiet meditation on life, the reaching out toward the universal and the infinite, and the courageous facing of one's profoundest wishes. Let parents sense and share with their children the glory and mystery of everyday things. Let them look with sympathy upon humanity's age-long dilemmas. Let no questions be taboo. The next generation can ill afford to have the deeper values deleted from the book of life. And now we'll light the peace lamp. May peace be with us. Try it from that side.
And now we will sing our gathering song. Feel free to rise as you are willing and able. It's hymn number 212, but the words are, excuse me? What?
Put the candle out, you're gonna catch on fire.
What?
The other candle still burns.
It's just a repeated
line. It's okay.
All right.
Thank you.
The gathering song is We Are Dancing Sarah's Circle. It is hymn 212, but the words are on the video, so either way.
We are dancing, Sarah's circle. We are dancing, Sarah's circle.
all ages. Today's moment for all ages is about a UU woman that I didn't know very much about. And she was a pioneer for women in ministry. She dedicated her life to opening doors for women. And this is kind of an interesting story. It comes from the P.T. Barnum Museum. And P.T. Barnum was a Universalist, and he helped Olympia Brown with her career. So if we can play the video.
The Universalist minister Olympia Brown was the first woman to be formally ordained by a religious denomination in the United States. At a time when congregations often vocally opposed the idea of women in leadership roles, she pushed through opposition to eventually become not just a minister, but the type who wasn't afraid to speak up for abolitionist causes or women's rights. In 1869, the board of Bridgeport's first Universalist church, where P.T. Barnum often attended services in his usual pew towards the front, offered Brown a job. She accepted, eventually marrying and starting her family in Bridgeport. But it was not all as smooth as that. As she came up for reappointment years later, voices in Bridgeport wondered if a woman minister was truly a good idea, and if it was worth putting such a firebrand back in the pulpit. In 1872, rumors circulated that a man might be hired in her place, and for more money, too. For his part, P.T. Barnum assured Brown that as to the salary question, he had told the opposition, quote, "If they engage the angel Gabriel, I will not pay more than I have done." Brown would eventually leave Bridgeport in 1876, but continued in both preaching and activism. She was still going strong when the 19th Amendment was ratified in 1920 and died 6 years later at 91 years old. That's today's Barnum fun fact, and if you didn't know, now you do.
So now we can sing the kids out to their classes if they haven't already gone. Now in peace, go now in peace. May the Spirit of love surround you everywhere, everywhere you may go. And now I will turn the pulpit over to Sheila Sangmeister. And she will be talking about the first of our three UU women that we're featuring today. Come on up, Sheila.
Powering over everybody. Susan B. Anthony, a pivotal figure in the fight for women's rights, dedicated her life to advocating for suffrage and equality, inspiring generations with her unwavering determination and impactful activism. Good morning, everyone. This morning, I ask you to hold in honor the legacy of a woman who dared to challenge the status quo and fought tirelessly for a world where women have their voices heard, Susan B. Anthony. Born in 1820, she was a woman of her time, yet her vision transcended it, giving the way to the women who came after her. Her unwavering commitment to equality and her refusal to accept the limitations placed upon women earned her a place in history as a true pioneer. Susan B. Anthony's journey began in a Quaker family where she learned the values of civil rights, justice, and fairness from a very young age. She became affiliated with the Unitarian faith and toward the end of her life embraced agnosticism, a philosophical stance that neither affirms nor denies the existence of God, but rather suggests that such knowledge is unattainable. Throughout her life, she demonstrated values and characteristics that align with Unitarian Universalists, including a commitment to social justice, equality, and the importance of individual conscience and action. While her family attended services at the First Unitarian Church of Rochester, Anthony's views evolved throughout her life. Her commitment to social justice, equality, and the importance of individual conscience and action are values and characteristics shared in our liberal religious tradition. So we will have to be satisfied calling her UU adjacent. An interesting sidebar, the Rochester Women's Right Convention of 1848 was held at that church, the First Unitarian Church of Rochester, further solidifying the Unitarian Church's connection to social reform. Anthony became involved in the abolitionist movement, working alongside figures like statesman, writer, activist, and her father's good friend, Frederick Douglass, and William Lloyd Garrison, an American abolitionist, journalist, and social reformer. Garrison supported the rights of women and became a prominent voice for the women's suffrage movement. This experience instilled in Anthony a deep sense of injustice and a burning desire to fight for the rights of marginalized groups, including women. A pivotal moment came when she was denied the opportunity to speak at a temperance convention because of her gender, igniting her passion for women's rights. She realized that no one would take women in politics seriously unless they had the right to vote, writing, "There never will be complete equality until women themselves help to make laws and elect lawmakers." In 1851, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, a fellow activist who would become her lifelong friend and an ally in the fight, she met Stanton, and they would become friends and allies in the fight for women's rights. Together, they founded the National Women's Suffrage Association, spearheading the movement for a woman's right to vote. Susan B. Anthony traveled the country, delivering passionate speeches and organizing petitions, facing ridicule and opposition at every turn. In 1872, she famously cast a ballot in the presidential election, knowing that this was an illegal act. She was arrested, tried, and fined, but instead of paying the fine, she refused to pay, continued to fight for her right to vote. Her actions and her words, especially her "Is it a crime to vote?" speech, became iconic symbols of the struggle for women's rights. Susan B. Anthony's efforts, along with those of other suffragists, laid the groundwork for the passage of the 19th Amendment in 1920, granting women the right to vote. She did not live to see the amendment ratified, but her legacy lives on in the progress made towards gender equality. Her unwavering dedication to justice and her belief in the inherent equality of all people continues to inspire her today. Susan B. Anthony's story reminds us that even when facing seemingly insurmountable, it's written in later ink, insurmountable obstacles, we must never give up our fight for a more just world. Let us honor her memory by continuing to fight for the rights of all, ensuring that the ideals of equality and justice are realized for everyone. Let us remember Susan B. Anthony's courage, her vision, and her unwavering commitment to equality. Let us carry her torch forward towards working for a future where everyone, regardless of gender, has the opportunity to reach their full potential and shape their own destiny. And let us strive to create a world where the words "we the people" mean "we all the people." Thank you.
For those following along with the order of service, you'll notice that we skipped a musical number. For those not following along the order of service, shucks, I shouldn't have said anything and you never would have noticed. We're going to catch that musical number up right now. It is "Let the Woman Vote," or "Let Mother Vote," sorry, by the SUFF's original Broadway cast.
Gentlemen, God bless our great republic, God bless our grand old flag, God bless the land of freedom we hold dear. And the heartbeat of that land will always be the home, and that, of course, is woman's sacred sphere. We nurture every family just as we're meant to do, so won't you let us nurture the too. Let mother vote, we raised you after all. Won't you thank the lady you have loved since you were small? We reared you, cheered you, helped you when you fell. With your blessing, we could help America as well. Let mother vote, we'll keep our country clean. We'll tidy up our politics until they are pristine. We would wash out any stain in society's domain. So, mister, won't you please let mother vote?
Let mother vote.
We've got the recipe
for a well-balanced government, fresh-baked with decency.
Two cups
maternal instinct, and the world's a better place.
Hey, mother, vote.
Let mother vote.
Let mother
vote. We'll nurse the USA until corruption, greed, and vice are sweetly swept away. We'll deploy domestic skills
to cure domestic ills. So, mister, won't you please let mother vote?
These brilliant guys, don't we deserve a little prize?
Let mother vote.
Don't worry, it's all right.
We'll still be there to hold you close
and tuck you in at night. It won't disrupt your lives. We'll still be loyal wives. So, mister, won't you please let mother vote?
Let mother vote.
Like father, vote like son.
And two good votes are better than one.
So please, please,
dear,
mother
vote.
Let your all-American mother vote.
Hi, I'm going to be speaking about Mary Livermore, who is someone I actually never heard of. And she dedicated herself to women's suffrage, temperance, and also Civil War aid. She was born in 1820 and grew up in Boston with her parents. In many ways, she had a very typical upbringing and early life for someone, you know, with the opportunity for education as a woman. So as a child, it was interesting to note that she displayed compassion, charity, and intellect, and was known for that all of her life. So she started out studying at the Hancock Grammar School and continued her education later at the Charlestown Female Seminary until 1836. She stayed on there and taught French, Italian, and Latin for a couple of years, but then something changed her life. She took a job, a position as a governess for the Henderson family in Virginia. And here she witnessed the extent of plantation slavery. So she left Virginia in 1842, a firm abolitionist. She then worked as a principal of a co-ed school in Duxbury, Massachusetts, and there she met her future husband, Daniel Parker Livermore. And Daniel was a Universalist minister, and she was very interested in his teachings because they emphasized salvation. So it attracted her because she struggled with her very strict Calvinist upbringing. So they married and had three children. Then Mary dedicated herself to the temperance movement, charity work, and she founded a variety of different organizations, including a home for aged women and the Hospital for Women and Children. She also became a board member of an organization called Home for the Friendless. Meanwhile, Daniel started a publication, a Universalist publication called the New Covenant. And at the New Covenant, Mary began to assist him as his associate editor. So she did that, and she wrote for all the different departments. She did travel for the church. She took charge of a lot of the paperwork and, you know, the business of operations. Her next major contribution was during the U.S. Civil War, and she and another woman, Jane Hodge, ran the Northwest branch of the Sanitary Commission in Chicago, which coordinated the United States relief effort and supported a huge number of sick and wounded. She organized relief groups, made speeches, wrote reports, news bulletins, etc. And she traveled actually to the front lines where she toured hospitals, delivered aid, wrote letters for the sick and dying, and accompanied some of the soldiers leaving the hospital. So realizing then the need for women to gain political influence, Mary committed herself to the suffrage movement. In 1868, she organized the Illinois Women's Suffrage Association and served as president. At that time, she created her own suffrage and temperance publication called, and I love this title, The Agitator. And I imagine she probably agitated a few people. So as a popular public speaker, Livermore basically joined the lecture circuit full time. And after leaving her position that she had at the Women's Journal, 1872, she gave an average of 150 lectures a year on a variety of topics, family, society, and women's role. And she gave her famous lecture, What Shall We Do With Our Daughters, it was called. And this encouraged women's education. She gave this lecture 800 times across the country. Until her death in 1905, Mary wrote and spoke in support of the suffrage and temperance movements. Her continued commitment actually progressed the lives of women and demonstrated her lifelong passion. And I would like to share a couple of quotes of Mary's to conclude. Above the titles of wife and mother, which although dear are transitory and accidental, there is the title of human being, which precedes and outranks every other. And finally, philanthropy is one of the most hopeful characteristics of our time. And I happen to believe that that holds true today. Philanthropy is one of the most hopeful characteristics of our time. The influence of Unitarian Universalism, or actually Universalism, became apparent in all of her work. And she's someone that I have come to really admire. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Karen McCann, and I'm here to present Margaret Moseley. Margaret lived from 1901 until 1997, a glorious 96 years of life. She was an African-American Unitarian civil rights activist from Dorchester, Mass. Margaret wanted to pursue nursing and business, but entrenched racial discrimination and white supremacy in both fields stopped her from doing either. She was turned down from every Boston area hospital, being told by many that, frankly, they did not accept blacks into their training programs. She had taken advanced math, science, and even some Latin classes so that she would be accepted. Moseley would instead go on to be involved in a number of racial and economic justice organizing efforts throughout her lifetime. She finally got married when she was 21. She says finally, because most women were married much younger in those days. God bless you. She and her family of three children went to Greater Boston and found a small home to live in. After a while, they were so cramped, they wanted a larger home. They found a lovely home in a two-family house. She hadn't been living there many months when the elderly woman, who was the landlady, sold it. Immediately, the new owner evicted them. And when she pressed him, he said he didn't have to give her a reason. There was nothing in the law that compelled him to give a reason for eviction. She said, it isn't because of non-payment. It's not because you haven't had a penny late. It's not for lack of upkeep of the home or the gardens. There can only be one reason. You don't want to answer, but I'm going to keep pressing you until you give me the answer. Is this because of race? He said, yes, I'm happy about your making me answer this. I don't intend to give a reason, but this is too nice a neighborhood for black people. He said, I bought this house as an investment. I'm not going to live here, and I have to protect my property. The words, this is too nice a neighborhood for black people, must have burned her brain. She told the new owner that she was going to seek a lawyer. She was shocked when she was told that according to current Massachusetts law, a landlord could evict people for any reason he desired. The owner of the property, usually a man, could do anything he pleased with the property. The tenant had no protection in the law for race or religion or any other difference was not protected. She said to the lawyer, I shall watch for any chance for the first bill that comes before the Massachusetts Senate or House to fight this because this is just inhuman. It wasn't too long after that she read in a Boston paper that a representative was presenting a bill in the State House on housing. She went every day to the hearings. At that time, she was Massachusetts legislative chairman for the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, WILPF is the acronym. She testified for them, but she also gave them her personal testimony because she also wanted that recorded. The bill was originally fairly acceptable, but by the time they got through with it, it was watered down, so wishy-washy. They said it would never have passed if they had kept increasing it. So every year for 3 years, they had to keep stepping up the provisions, and every year she was there to pass, to testify until it passed. Margaret helped found the Consumers Cooperative in the 1940s in Boston. She served on the board of the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts, now known as the ACLU. And the Freedom House in Roxbury, which promoted civil rights for blacks and equality in education. After moving her family to Cape Cod in the 60s, Margaret helped found chapters of the NAACP and the WILPF in Cape Cod. She was a founding member of the Community Action Committee of Cape Cod and the Fair Housing Committee. Margaret was also deeply involved in church governance and leadership, including acting as the president of the community church in Boston and in a number of roles at the Unitarian Church of Barnstable, becoming a founding member of the Social Responsibility Committee and the first woman to chair the Prudential Committee, which is the governing body of that church. She served as Massachusetts legislative chair for the WILPF, which in 1989 established the Margaret Moseley Memorial Peace Education Fund in her honor. She was also on the boards of the Cape Cod Section 8 Housing, the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, and the Elder Services of Cape Cod and the Islands. When the United Nations first started in 1945, Margaret went to the UN as often as she could. A number of times, she attended sessions of Eleanor Roosevelt's Commission on Human Rights. After the UN ratification of the UDHR, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in 1948, Margaret spoke to many church groups about it. This declaration contained economic and social rights, whereas the US Declaration of Independence and our Constitution were more civil and political. We brought democracy into these global areas of life, but we did not carry it into economic areas, thus the UDHR. At one time, when Margaret was a store manager of a consumer's cooperative store, she had the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in the window. And then she also had the consumer's cooperative principles, which are also democratic. And yet this was a store selling groceries. People would come in and ask if she was a communist. A local minister came in one day and walked around looking at the displays. Margaret knew he was trying to size things up. He finally came to the counter with one lemon. That was his total purchase. She smiled and asked what she could do for him. He bought the lemon and then said, "By the way, is this a communist outfit?" She said, "No, it's quite the opposite." He said, "Well, where do you ever see a store that has educational postings in the windows?" Margaret answered, "I feel my job is as much a job of education as it is to sell commodities." So he asked a whole lot more questions. While she waited on customers, he would stand there and then ask questions between customers. He said, "You have meetings here sometimes at night, don't you?" She said they did. Her husband, Emerson, would set up chairs in the store and people would come, and there was never enough seating. The minister said, "Would you like to come to our parish hall?" She told him she would. He said, "All right, since this is an educational venture, I'm happy to let you use the space." Margaret felt this was a real victory, from asking if she and the people she was working with were communists to offering her the parish hall for her meetings. She told him the state had even sent her a check to put on one course because they were trying to encourage, through the federal government, a better understanding of cooperation for low-income communities. And this is a photo of Martin Luther King Jr., who visited Boston in 1958. And she is presenting him with a check that she had collected for his civil rights, continuance of his civil rights work. Margaret's group separated from the NAACP, not because they didn't approve of the NAACP, but they found that being an independent group, they could reach more people than if they said they were a committee of the NAACP. Feelings on the Cape at that time were running quite strong. There was a lot of discrimination. There were a great many people who didn't like to have things identified with the NAACP or any other interest group of that kind that could be identified with a racial issue. Remember, this was the early 60s. The smaller group did many things for housing, those who could not get housing on their own. They bought a house, let a low-income family rent it, and then they put their rent toward the mortgage until the family could take over the entire mortgage themselves and assume ownership. This was a first. When the so-called reverse freedom riders were sent to the Cape, Southerners were so opposed to the freedom riders that they rounded up and forced blacks to board the buses used by the freedom riders. And as a form of protest, they sent the buses back up north. Sounds a little familiar. This presented this small community with a large problem. Margaret simply appeared with other Unitarians, not waiting to be asked. They responded to these people's needs calmly, quietly, naturally. Not only her labors, but also her advice and counsel were helpful to these folks until they got back home. A former minister of the Barnstable Unitarian Church and friend of Margaret's said the members of the Unitarian Church are constantly learning and growing. It is gratifying to see how new thoughts, new ideas, and new ways are always accepted with pleasure and delight. The outreach to the community is quite outstanding. That is truly a test of one's convictions. Margaret used to say, social justice work is like moving a mountain one stone at a time. Thank you. And now a moment of reflection. Savage Daughter by Ekaterina Shilajova. Thank you.
My mom. sharp stones. I am my mother's savage daughter. I will not cut my hair. I will not lower my voice. My mother's child is a savage. She looks for her omens in the colors of stones, in the faces of cats, in the falling of feathers, in the dancing of fire, in the curve of old bones. I am my mother's savage daughter, the one who runs barefoot cursing sharp stones. I am my mother's savage daughter. I will not cut my hair. I will not lower my voice. My mother's child dances in the darkness. She sings heathen songs by the light of the moon, and watches the stars and renames the planets, and dreams she can reach them with a song and a broom. Out of darkness into this world, through blood and through pain, and deep in our bones the old songs are waking, so sing them with voices of thunder and rain. We are our mother's savage daughters, the one who runs barefoot cursing sharp stones. We are our mother's savage daughters. We will not cut our hair.
Waves of joy and sorrow. When those waves become too much for us to hold by ourselves, we share. Let us now take a moment to share in this caring community any matter we hold in our heart which spills out for support or celebration. Online, you can let the host know. In person, you can come forward and speak briefly into the microphone. Please start with your name. Come, let us share together.
We can bring this time of sharing to a close. As we often do, we will sing Spirit of Life.
Spirit of Life, come unto me. Sing in my heart all the stirrings of compassion. Blow in the wind, rise in the sea, move in the hand, giving life the shape of justice. Roots hold me close, wings set me free. Spirit of Life, come to me, come to me, softly. Spirit of Life, come unto me. Sing in my heart all the stirrings of compassion. Blow in the wind, rise in the sea, move in the hand, giving life the shape of justice. Roots hold me close, wings set me free. Come to me, come to me.
I have reading 431 from the Blue Hymnal by Barbara Wells. O spinner, weaver of our lives, your loom is love. May we who are gathered here be empowered by that love to weave new patterns of truth and justice into a web of life that is strong, beautiful, and everlasting.
And now we have a song that's from our gray hymnal, As We Come Marching, Marching, hymn 109. So feel free to stand up if you like and sing. The hymnals are in the back, but the words are on the screen. And I just want to say another name for this song is called Bread and Roses, and that's why we have bread and roses on our altar here.
That a sudden sun discloses for the people here singing bread and roses, bread and roses. As we go marching, marching, we battle too for men, for they are women's children and we
And that was about mining in Ireland. But this song was written, I think, about the mill strike in New York City when women walked out of the mills. So thank you for joining us today and learning about some women in the history of Unitarian Universalism that had an impact on our lives even today. And I will extinguish our chalice. And then Susan Hare will do our announcements.